Greenhorns. This is Greenhorns Radio. This is Severin. I'm very happy to be with you once again after a long, cold, wintry break. Today we are joining with Josh Morgenthau of Morgenthau. Well, it's actually called Fishtail Farms, and it's in Fishtail, yes. New York. Hey, Josh, are you there?
Hi, Severin. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Oh, so exciting. I am very thrilled, and we just bumped into each other at the NOFA New York conference, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
Did you have a nice time at the conference, Josh?
Yeah, it was good. It's always interesting. There's a range of people there, so some of the workshops are, you know, geared towards home gardeners, and, you know, some of them are geared more towards commercial farmers, but there was a lot of useful stuff going on.
Useful stuff is what's going on. Josh is farming in Fishtail, New York. Maybe you could tell our regular listeners your general introductory spiel about your farm and what your practices are and how it's evolving, that farm project there.
Sure. So the farm is Fishtail Farms. It's about 300 acres, and we farm about 150 acres. It was started by my grandfather in 1913, and it was originally over 1,000 acres, but over time it, you know, struggled like a lot of local farms, and it was actually divided between my father and his siblings. And now we're down to 300 acres. We grow apples, peaches, pears, nectarines, other fruits. We've recently added vegetables and livestock.
So you're walking into a farm operation that was established two generations ago and was managed before you got there under a different set of objectives. What were you bringing when you brought, when you came walking into an existing farm operation, and how have you adapted and changed the operation's focus?
I mean, it's funny. I didn't bring much to the table other than the just an urge to keep the farm alive, I also the environment and not wanting, to eat food with pesticides or to, contribute to the amount of pesticides going on food has always been important to me. So that was sort of a secondary goal. But the real, original thing was just to try to keep the farm going. It had been, my grandfather started it. He was sort of a gentleman farmer. He wasn't actually pruning the trees. He had a farm manager, and the farm was, something that for him was not, he wasn't farming out of economic necessity. It was just something he wanted to do. But over time, as the farm is, pieces have been sold off, and as it struggled, it's become clear that it, it needs to make ends meet to keep going. And so, I didn't actually have agricultural training from school. I was, majored in something totally different. And but
what did
I
you
moved
major
to the farm
in, Josh?
After
you have to admit
school because I. Go ahead.
What did you major in?
Painting, and fine art. And I still, have this illusion that I'm gonna paint during the winter. I've actually have been able to do a little painting this winter, but a lot of your goals of doing other things, as soon as you get really involved in farming, you focus, and that everything seems to everything else fades into the background. I basically came at it a couple years ago, and it had been, we'd been leasing it out. My father had leased the farm out to other growers because our manager had retired, and they weren't really taking care of the orchard. And it was sort of at this crossroads that either it was maybe going to end up like a lot of the other farms in the area, and grow some houses or needed a kind of new model and new energy. And so, I mean, that's, I came in just with the urge to give it a go.
So you're giving it kind of a great go, and you're working in partnership with other people, which is very characteristic of our generation's entrepreneurs, is, innovative partnerships. Tell me about your rest of your farm team there, including your lovely Hannah.
Well, Hannah, my partner, we went to school together, and afterwards when I decided to move up to the farm and do it full time, she came with me, and she's been great because, I guess I have to step back and give a little about how we market. We're mainly a pick-your-own farm, and so there's an on-farm market, and then in season, starting with cherries and going through peaches and nectarines, and then into apples and pears, we have a crowd of people that come to the farm mainly on the weekends to pick their own. So she came in, and while I was learning how to grow fruit, she was learning how to manage the personnel side of it, the pick your own operation and the farm market. And I think maybe like a lot of young farmers, when I first started, I was so excited by the idea of growing everything. So we decided that, we also wanted a vegetable operation in addition to the fruit, which was, all that the farm had at the time, a couple of years ago. So I put out, postings on NOFA and other sustainable agriculture websites, and met a bunch of, other farmers, and ended up meeting a couple who had been farming in Maine, Julia Trunzo and Fox June, and they had a ton of really good experience growing organic veggies. And so they pioneered a vegetable operation, which is, each year over the past couple of years has gone, doubled in acreage.
So you're charging away with great ambition, learning a lot really fast. And Hannah, having to learn this customer service side of things, which isn't always the most intuitive part of agriculture, but clearly bringing the food to the table is only part of the equation. You also have to convince someone to pay for it.
Exactly.
Maybe you could share a little bit about, walking into that situation, what you could share with others who are learning about marketing.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do wrong?
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, nothing. Just what did you do wrong and what did you do right?
Well, I think we did everything wrong before we did anything right. But, at the same time, we were really lucky because despite the changes in management, the farm, the apple trees had been, in the ground producing for years. And we had a kind of a built-in pick-your-own following, so that was, really helpful to, come September, October, have a whole slew of people show up to pick apples, even though they may not have known that it was now being managed by a bunch of young farmers who wanted to, turn the orchard organic. I think, what I've learned is that rather than doing what we did, which is try to do everything at once, that it makes sense to build up gradually and to pick a few marketing channels. I mean, diversity is good, but I think one of the most important things in farming is that, when you try to do too much and you don't do everything right, you lose the efficiency that already, it's so hard at a small scale to compete with market prices. But once, if you are, have too many things going on and you lose even more efficiency, it becomes really hard to make ends meet.
And did you find that your customers were slightly forgiving, but then ultimately not that forgiving of any small errors that you made?
Well, you don't... I don't think we had any huge disasters with our customers. I mean, one interesting thing is that I've been using a material on the apples, and I don't know how many listeners know very much about, apples, but they're really one of the hardest crops to grow organically, and if you don't spray them with something in the Northeast, you don't get a crop. So it's always, you know, a dilemma of what to spray them with. But I've been spraying the apples with a new material that's organic, and it's kaolin clay. It's just a fine white powder. And rather than killing, you know, the insects that would be destroying your fruit, you're just camouflaging the fruit, and it acts as a repellent. The problem is, you know, come picking time, the trees look completely white. It looks like, you know, Christmas. And so training our customers that, no, we weren't spraying more pesticides, we were actually avoiding pesticides, and that this white powder is just clay that they can wipe off. And that was the type of thing that had some, had some interesting altercations and people getting kind of furious. But ultimately, you know, the people that are not your market will just go away, and you know, hopefully what you're doing is going to connect to some group of people, and word of mouth will spread that to more, you know, of your target market, and you'll end up growing, which I think has happened. We've seen that a lot. I mean, we definitely had a lot of, you know, pick your own customers that were upset about the price or this or that, and eventually they just don't come back. But then the people that really appreciate what you're doing do come back.
Hello? Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, good. The people who appreciate what you're doing will come back, and those who are willing to be educated about kaolin clay, which looks crazy but which is much less toxic, ultimately are engaging in it's called customer education?
I guess so, yeah.
Oftentimes, I feel that some of the burden of customer education should be borne by such institutions as Whole Foods. I feel like they could do a really good job explaining about growing practices.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how you're teaching, or what's the language is it using? Are you using placards on the farm stand, or are you just explaining like one by one by one to each person mm-hmm. about kaolin clay? Or like from a communication standpoint, how do you teach that moment?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of everything, I think, and of course, you know, you can't reach everybody, but one thing that we figured out is you know, when we have pick-your-own customers coming in, we have to give them a bag, and we have to give them a little bit of a rundown of what's in season, what, you know, give them a map of the orchard and say what is ready to pick and what isn't. So one of the first things that we did that really helped was, you know, printed up a map with pretty detailed information on our growing practices on the back, and that, you know, is a big help. We were able to put one of those maps in every customer's hand, and you know, not all of them read it, and we'd still get calls from people, you know, who were in our orchard calling our farm store and saying, you know, what the heck is this white stuff on the apples? And then I'd have to tell them, well, did you get a map? And they'd say yes, and then I'd ask, well, you see the part that says, what's that white stuff on the apples? And then they'd, you know, feel embarrassed and they'd eventually read it and then be happy.
Okay.
So that was one thing, and I think the web is another thing that, you know, is really has a tremendous potential for small farms and for fledgling farms. I mean, I think just by having a good website, have been able to attract, you know, a huge amount of new customers to the farm. And I think, you know, if anyone is getting involved in a farm and trying to figure out how to market themselves, the first thing they should think about is just investing in a you know, simple but informative web page.
Simple but informative web presence.
Yeah.
It looks good. And you managed to get the attention of some pretty high-profile fruit pickers there. I remember the gossip when it traveled up the valley.
Yeah, we still don't know how that's going to affect the business. You know, Gyllenhaal.
Wait,
and
not everybody might have noticed the
farm.
Paparazzi.
What's that?
You might have to explain. Not everybody's really who listens to this show is so in tune with the paparazzi. So you may need to explain a little bit what we're talking about.
Well, I didn't actually see anything, but I was just, you know, one weekend day towards the end of the season, you know, this apple season, a bunch of our pick-your-own staff who were, you know, largely comprised of high school girls were, you know, screaming and giggling, and apparently Jake Gyllenhaal and Taylor Swift had come to the farm on a date, and then, you know, thereafter we had paparazzi from different tabloids showing up at the farm asking about it. But the funny thing is that it was at the end of our season, and I haven't seen any real, other than, you know, a lot of inquisitive people, I haven't seen how it's going to affect the farm. But, yeah, I think if you can get celebrities to come to your farm, it can't really hurt.
Well, and then of course they'll be so powerfully nourished that they may decide to buy farms themselves and stop being celebrities and become farmers, which of course would be the most relevant decision that could be made.
Yeah, that would be relevant. I somehow don't
that's
know if
my
that's
hope.
Happen anytime soon, but we're on our way.
We're on our way. So you're going gangbusters. You went straight into all sorts of things. You learned a lot of hard lessons. You had a barn burn down. That was big.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your barn.
Not this year, but last season was really difficult. It was kind of in some ways, our first season really geared up. We were doing vegetables and really pushing pushing our pick-your-own crops, and we just gotten a flock of sheep, and that was the first season that I was working with Fox and Julia, our vegetable growers, and it was just one of the wettest seasons ever. I mean, it was pretty much constant rain from May through, you know, August, and then, you know, early summer, our barn just burnt down, and it was an old, huge old barn. Part of it had been on the farm when my grandfather purchased the land in 1913, and part of it, you know, was additions that were put on later. And it was, in some ways, it was falling apart already, and we didn't really know what to do with it. But, you know, it really doesn't hurt to have a place to store your tractors when you're starting out. And we still, to this day, don't really know what happened. We were all out in the field and saw, you know, plumes of smoke. And when we got up to the barn, which is on a hill, there were, you know, our acetylene welder was exploding, and it was just, you know, way too crazy to even figure out what had gone on. And the whole thing ended up burning down with a, you know, not luckily a lot of our equipment was outside, but definitely some useful farm equipment and some of my family heirlooms as well were in it. So that was, it was definitely a setback. And then we, of course, had such a rainy season. We had kind of no shelter. But we really luckily were able to put up a more modest but still pretty, you know, nice barn this past spring. And, you know, once you've really done it with nothing, it's really nice to start getting some of the tools and infrastructure that you need to do what you want to do.
Tools and structures for new farms. And did you have to get a loan, or did you manage to find investors, or what was your financial implications of that?
And we have had to take out some loans, but we another big thing for the farm is that we've gone into the process of selling our development rights, and that you know, the state will purchase the development rights for farms. And they've now, with the state budget problems, they've raided that fund, and the projects that have already been cleared are waiting, you know, 5+ years to have that funding come through. And we haven't gotten the funding, but with that pledge as collateral, we've been able to receive some bridge loans to help us, you know, jumpstart us.
So you're just waiting on state money coming through. And I've heard, I spoke with the American Farmland Trust lady, and she said that there are something like $20 million worth of projects that are waiting for the budget to be allocated. Is that square with what you've heard?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds right, yes. But I think it's $20 million in pledged but not yet funded projects. And, yeah, we have, there are farms that, you know, won that grant, purchase of development rights, years before us, that still haven't received their money.
So if Vilsack is listening, or any of his staffers, and he's interested to support beginning farmers, one critical way for that support to be made manifest is to allocate either federal money or urge states to put the money into the easement bank account, such that the Eden bank account can pay out to the farmers who are doing the right thing and preserving their land for agriculture.
Absolutely.
Now, what time remains with us? Oh, not very much. We have about 3 minutes. Josh, is there something that's coming up farm event-wise or work party-wise or training-wise that you want to make sure that everybody knows about?
No, we're pretty slow, you know, this winter. I mean, we actually had enough, storage crops and other things that were either coming out of the field or the greenhouse that we did a winter CSA share this year. And that's one thing I didn't talk about before, but, you know, when I was talking about how we started out with too many markets, we're doing pick your own and farmers markets and some wholesale. And then recently this year we started a CSA, which sort of goes against my rule of simplifying and focusing on what you can be good at, because it was a whole other marketing venture. But it's been really exciting. And in some ways I kind of see the whole farm going in that direction. And maybe some hybrid of a pick-your-own operation and a CSA, but so we're just running our winter CSA, and pretty soon we're going to be opening for next season CSA, and that, I mean, right now we're not delivering off the farm. It's really for local customers, you know, people living near enough to East Fishkill, so Westchester, Lower Hudson Valley, but
you're seeing, you know, the potential of the marketplace, which is right at your doorstep.
Exactly. Plus, you know, then you know the thing about pick your own that's awesome is that you have all these people that you've never seen before come to your farm and, you know, spending money. But that's also the thing about it that's kind of crazy is you have a ton of people who you know nothing about. A lot of whom are just intent on stealing produce. So the CSA is a really good way to know who your customers are and connect with them. And of course, you know, if there's a rainy weekend, they'll still show up, whereas a lot of your, you know, fair weather customers won't.
Yeah, commitment and reciprocity. These are the values of the agrarian culture, which are very different from kind of the convenience culture, which we've all become accustomed to in this society, but of course, which is deeply incompatible with farming.
Yeah, it is. And the cool thing about CSA members is that the CSA really asks a commitment, and I think that's kind of a value that's so is missing from so many people's lives, that the people that are doing it just feel such a sense of pride and ownership and you know, commitment, which is just a unique thing.
And of course, it's been found and shown and proven and documented that CSA customers are getting the best deal on produce. So that, you know, that commitment goes a long way in terms of, you know, what you get for what you give. So I'm applauding all your very philosophical thinking about the marketplace and what kind of farm you organism you want to be running. In our remaining minute, I do want to make mention of some upcoming things from Greenhorn's side of the world. As I mentioned, we had the NOFA New York Mixer last weekend. This coming weekend is PASA, Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Ag Education. We're also doing a sneak screening of the film at Eco Farm, which is in California. I'm in California right now, about to go to that conference. And there are it's just going off right now. I mean, we are doing events all over the place, showing the film and doing mixers. And I really urge you guys to go on the website and look at the schedule of events. Particularly for April, when I think we're in like 12 states in April. So lots going on, and thank you, Josh. Thank you,
thank
listeners.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Happy New Year.